I'm delighted to be asked by Conal to chair this penultimate panel on Pentecost. Not easy to say when you've been drinking. But I have two Northern Stars here in many ways to kind of finish this session with. We've got Adrian Dunbar and Barbara Adair. My name is Mark Phelan, and I work in the drama department at Queen's. And as someone who works primarily as a theatre historian, I profoundly kind of feel that we cannot engage with modern Irish political history unless we engage with our artists, and particularly the work of our playwrights, especially when you consider the role, literally and figuratively, that theatre has played in staging the nation and shaping the geographical imaginary of Irish republicanism and unionism, but also in contesting and in critiquing those contours. It seems also that playwrights, more than politicians and more than other kind of figures who work very much in the public sphere, playwrights have always had a keen sense of awareness that history isn't over yet. That's a theme that seems powerfully and profoundly manifest in all of Stuart's plays, including arguably his latest and his greatest play, Pentecost, which we're going to discuss today. Pentecost, for those of you, some of you may not know the play, Pentecost is the last of three plays, a triptych of plays, as Stuart Parker called them, three plays for Ireland. They're set in the 18th, 19th and 20th centuries. But what Parker was a lovely kind of playful wit, is my favourite stage description in modern Irish drama. He says that all three plays are set in Ireland, the continuous past. In the sense that you may be done with the past, but the past ain't done with you. The first of those plays is set in Belfast in the 18th century. It involves Henry Joy McCracken as a leader, perforce kind of leader of the United Irishmen. The second play is Heavenly Bodies, which is set in the 19th century and deals with the greatest playwright, largely forgotten by the canon, Dion Boucicault, and his interaction with a comic clown called Johnny Patterson, who, in a lovely kind of playful kind of manner, I don't mean this in a pejorative way, he is the author of The Hat My Father Wore, which subsequently got regrafted and redrafted with alternative lyrics, become The Sash My Father Wore, a song which is authored by a singing clown from County Clare, which is kind of an interesting little nugget. The last of the plays, in the three plays for Ireland, is Pentecost, which is set in 1974 and involves a house that is on very much in the interface between the Prodger on one side of the Tage and the other, says one of the characters. It's set at the height of the Ulster Worker Council's strike, and the house has just been bequeathed to Lenny and Marion, a relationship that is between two Catholic characters whose relationship is kind of foundered. The owner of the house was played by is owned by somebody called Lily, who is 74 years old when she dies. The house is left as it was until she died. The first exchange of the play is when Lenny arrives into the house after coming from her funeral. Lily herself is 74 years old, and in many ways she's an embodiment of a working class loyalist experience of a culture and a community. Is embodied in this spectral figure of her as a ghost. In some ways she's also like a kind of a Presbyterian, a free Presbyterian Kathleen O'Houlihan. Her first lines, largely to Marion, get out of my house, driving strangers out of the house. So the house is very much allegorical signification, and in the characters in the plays we have Lenny and we have Marion. We have the ghost of Lily Matthews, who only Marion sees. We have Peter, who's a friend of theirs, who's returned back from England, and he's completely befuddled about the kind of the strike. And we have Ruth, who is a wife of an RUC man, who also flees to the house. So we have these. All of these characters are described as refugees in this house, and outside is the chaos and the confusion of the Ulster Worker Council's strike. And we track the play as these personal lives play out, but very much we have a political drama taking place off stage. And really, that's all I'm going to say, just to kind of lay a little bit of an understanding to the context of the play. It's one of the greatest masterpieces of modern Irish drama. It has a particular voltage and valency for audiences from here. It's also something, and it's not just a plug, but it's being staged in September by the Lyric Theatre. It's going to be directed by kind of Jimmy Fay. So if you don't know it, it behoves you to go and see it, particularly with the day that's in it and the discussions that we've had today. One other little thing I'll just say as well too is that Stuart Parker hailed from the shipyards, from a working class loyalist family. An uncle of his was a UVF gun runner. involved in Larne, and he spent some of the years, 1964 to 1969, he spent those years in America, where he got radicalised teaching in America, particularly in the context of the civil rights movement in America, and the draft protests of African Americans against the Vietnam War. And he returned back to Belfast after being driven off from Cork from his great friend from the East, Sam Fannin, and he arrives in Belfast the day the British troops were on the ground. He also felt that the Ulster Workers' Strike, right in his play in 1987, when he started writing much earlier, but it was dated 1987, he died 1 year later. He also felt that the Ulster Worker Council strike was a cataclysm for his community and for a broader kind of community. But again, I think it's a very nuanced kind of play. It certainly isn't a political football, and it's not a diatribe. But I think it's a wonderful opportunity, since we've had a lot of the significant players and personnel involved in the Ulster Worker strike, to have a response in the panel that's been created by Conal, of two of her finest actors who were both involved in multiple productions in London, both by Field Day and in London, but also on stage and in television. So we have Barbara Adair and well, you know who this is, Adrian Dunbar. So I'm not going to say really anything more than that. I'm going to hand over to kind of Adrian and Barbara, and we will hopefully have some excerpts from the play, some discussion about the particular performances and what it meant to both of the actors, and plenty of room, hopefully, for discussion towards the end.
Thought you said you had nothing to say. Since I've got very little to say, I said, away you go. 20 minutes later. I was living on the Gavahi Road in 1974 when the Loyalist strike was called and made the place ungovernable. I remember the women in the factory, in the shirt factory on the Gavahi Road, facing one another across the machines, and you know, we knew what it was going to what was going to happen, because there was going to be shortages. People were going to be left hungry. It was going to be a very difficult time for everybody. It was at a time there was these guys called the Tartan Gangs, which were a spin-off from the Bay City Rollers. Only Northern Ireland could do it. And they came in busloads from Lurgan, and they wrecked the front street of the town. They broke into two off licences, and they drunk a hell of a lot of cream of the barley, I suspect. And they came down to the Gervahi Road to wreck our estate, which was beautifully called Churchill Park, being the major nationalist estate in the town. So for 2 days, what had happened was everybody had gone up to a new estate called Ballyorn, and they had taken all the, they took all the, you know, the wood, and they barricaded the whole estate up. So it was a massive job. It took 2 days to do it. And it was just the local people did it. Anyway, approximately about 3,000, it was later said by the RUC, who, by the way, left the streets, as we know. I mean, one of the scary things about the Loyalist strikes was the understanding that the police were entirely in collusion with Protestant paramilitaries. I mean, that was like, just, you couldn't believe that, you know, that penny dropped very heavily. So you saw that happen. I saw that. Everybody saw that happen. So anyway, they came to wreck our estate. There was no forces of law and order, but suddenly, out of the middle of nowhere, there came an army Land Rover with five members of the Royal Green Jackets, who just swung around the top at Drumcree and came down the road. And you could see them, they just stopped and they saw what was coming at them. And the captain got out of the back of the thing, and he ordered them out of the back, and they got down on their knees and they fired four volleys of shots above the heads of this crowd and dispersed them. And only for that, I think that it could have been carnage there, because they turned at that point, of course, and they left. And some, they restored some order. So that was the kind of my first experience, though, was even scarier than that, because I came up to do in 72, I think it was, a meeting at the Polytechnic to get in to the Polytechnic. And when I arrived at the bottom at about 6, 7 o'clock in the morning at Shaftesbury Square, the whole place was closed off. So I thought, how are we going to get to York Street Station? I'd hardly ever been to Belfast before. I saw a police car and I flagged it down with a fella called John Kelly. And I said to the police, would you take us down? And they said, get in. It was the worst thing they ever did. By the time we got down to the Europa, every panel in the car had been kicked to bits. It was very scary. And they told us, they said, boys, just get out. They'd made a big mistake. God help them. But they got us. We got to the poly anyway. So my whole understanding of what the loyalist strike meant that we would always be in thrall to East Belfast. We would always be in thrall to a small bunch of people in East Belfast who were always going to be able to turn the screw on the British government whenever they felt like it. And I thought that was very scary. I also realised that years later, the Sunningdale Agreement was going to re-emerge as the Good Friday Agreement. And I thought, what a chance miss that must have been for those people who put their energies into the Sunningdale Agreement, because it could have saved us all a lot of time and heartache. However, we are where we are now. And when I came across Pentecost by Stuart Parker, I thought, here we go, at last. Someone from that place, someone from the Protestant disenfranchised East Belfast, someone from Belfast who's representing that Protestant voice in the theatre in a radical and cogent way that I can get behind from my background, that I can put my energies into. And Pentecost was that play for me. And I thought, it was so wonderful to meet Stuart Parker, because he came from that constituency, because he understood it very well, and because he was mapping a road out. He was very well aware of the inheritance of that community. He was very well aware that the inheritance of that community, had been disinherited subsequently from that the glory, if you like, of that particular community. So it was great to meet Stuart for a start, who was the most fantastic, wonderful man, and as Barry said to me earlier, a very good man, and he was a very good man. And it was great to see him in a humorous and intelligent way present this very tense moment in history. And the claustrophobia that he created within the house was wonderful. This girl who was married to an RUC man, she'd been knocked about a bit, you know, as did happen, because the RUC were under so much pressure at that time. There was a lot of family tensions and so forth. That was and suicides and those things were coming up consistently. So that was that character. And you had the character of Lenny, you had the kind of the laissez-faire Queen's graduate who kind of has a kind of attitude to the world where they're kind of slightly without it, and they might be able to kind of get out of here quicker than anybody else. So there was a lot of humour in it, there was a lot of tension in it, and there was a lot of exploration as to where we were at. But ultimately what Stuart offered was a redemptive end to it all, because the ending of the play is very significant. The ending of the play is simply telling us that, you know, the dead, you know, the innocent dead of the Troubles they're not our debtors, they're our creditors. They are people that we have to live the best life we can because of what's happened to them. We can't get stuck, we can't get stopped in stasis, we must move on in a positive way. So the play offered that at the end, but it also offered an insight into the working class Protestant mindset, which was consistently used and abused as far as I could ever see, because it had really no political outlet. It did not have the statesman-like people to ever govern it. And that's why, you know, we are consistently held in thrall to East Belfast. The play is very good. It's a beautiful play. I'd advise anybody to go and see it. It was really significant for me in my life, obviously. I will be going to see it again, for sure. Barry, would you like to say something? This is Barry, by the way, who's one of our greatest actresses and has been for a number of years.
Thanks very much. No, the only experience I had with the Troubles at that time was a funny one, because I was teaching in Mersey Street Primary School, which is right in the heart of UDA land. And the headmaster, who was a very decisive man, said, "Nobody's going to tell me to close my school. I take my orders from Academy Street. I don't take my orders from gunmen. But, if anybody comes around with a gun, we'll just close the school." So the teachers were told to come in anyway. So we came in anyway. I remember I was sitting in the staff room with the door, open door beside me here, and I saw the girls facing me going. And I looked around, and here's this great big fella. I mean, he really filled the door. He was about 6'4" and built with it. And I thought, this is it. We're having it. And he says, "Is the school closed?" And I said, well, we're here anyway. And he says, "Well, that's all right. I just didn't know whether to bring the wee girl in or not. I'll leave her in the playground." So that was okay. The school was open. And by lunchtime, the word had got round that the school was open, and we had about a 90% attendance. Few people kept their children home. Don't know why, because it didn't actually make any difference. But the point is that day, Braniel School, you know, the Braniel Estate, which is also, I think, a Protestant estate, when the women came down with their wains to put them into school, there was a group of young teenagers, not even big fellas, 14 and 15-year-olds, saying, "You can't go in, the school is closed." And he said, "Well, the teachers' cars are there. I will let the teachers in, but we're not letting the kids in." So the mothers took their kids home. And one of them had a mother who lived in Mercy Street, and she happened to ring her up and said, "In that awful, the school's closed." And the mother says, "Well, Mercy Street school's not closed." She says, "What?" She went out, collected all the other mothers that she knew, grabbed the kids, marched down to the school and said to the kids, "Mersey Street school's open, and if Mersey Street can be open, by God we can. Clear out." And they did clear out, and the school was opened and it stayed open. That was my experience of the trouble. Well, mostly, because I live in a nice, respectable Protestant area, so there wasn't really all that much trouble, you know. Except we were stopped in the car by kids. "You can't come this way." He said, "I live up there." He says, "You can't go there." So we had to go round the other way, and we could have come up round behind them. And, you know, there was nothing. There was nothing. It was just them, a barrier of youngsters. But you were afraid to do anything because we did hear of children stopping a car, and the driver got out and says, "Tell me what to do, blooming kids." And then the big men come out from behind the barrier where they'd been hiding and beat them up. Anyway, that's my experience.
And then the play.
And then the play. I'll do you a bit. This is Lily, the ghost.
Sorry, Barbara, you wouldn't mind just give a little bit of context to people about before the speech comes in the play?
Yes. I don't actually remember where it comes. It's Act 1, Scene 2. Oh, yes, it's quite early on. This is quite early on in the play, and Lily appears as the age she was when she died, 74. So I'll have to play down a wee bit. she actually gets younger in the next scene. She's in her 50s, and in the last scene, she's in her 30s. As Marion finds out from various things in the house more about her. But this is where Marion doesn't know all that much about her, just she's a blooming out Protestant bitch from East Belfast. Anyway, this is Marion. I'm sorry I have to read it. It's a long time since I played it. "I don't want you in my house. I don't want you in here breathing strong drink and profanity. And your husband deserted. I want no truck with any of yous. Stay you with your own and let me rest easy with mine. You're here with all that's in you. This house was my life. You know nothing about it. You'd be singing on the other side of your face if my Alfie was here. It was Alfie Matthews found this house. It was him put down the deposit, moved the pair of us into it within a week of them building it. The year of 1918, and me, a bride at 18 years of age. Alfie had come back, that's why, back from Passchendaele. Hellfire Corner, Back from the Dead. Him and Jackie Midgley, the only two out of Hope Street of the 12 that went. All in 1 week. Married, moved in. He wouldn't wait, not after what he'd seen. This house was his life, the same as it's mine. He never left it, not for a night, except once to try and find work in the Depression. That and the day they carried him to his grave. You have no right to be in here. My man would take a stout like any other of a Friday night. What harm in that? He never lifted a finger to me. Not once in 41 years of marriage, no matter what amount of drink was in him. Never harmed a living soul. Every pipe in this house was led by his hands. The plumbing, the gas. Gas fitting was his trade. Every pipe had to be put back, and it was him put them back after your crowd burnt it down round us. 3 years we'd been in this street. 3 years sacrificing for every little stick we possessed. All we'd managed to scrape together, destroyed in one night. It's a mercy we even lived through it. Me crouched in there in the pantry, crying out to the Lord Jesus to deliver us. Alfie out in the yard trying to block up the back door. But they came in over the wall, bit him senseless to the ground, and on into this very kitchen, roaring and rampaging like the cruel heathens they were. They're smashing those gas mantles with their clubs and cudgels till the whole house went up. I was trapped in that pantry for a solid hour, Alfie lying bleeding in the yard. It hadn't been for the fire brigade, but lads coming in as fast as they did, I wouldn't be here now. Smoke, ashes, scorched walls, water flooded everywhere, my beautiful house. There was sky showing part of the rafters. Everything we'd saved up for, ruined in one night by a pack of Fenian savages. So there.
Tempted Barbara to get you to read out the rest of the play there as well. But to give it a bit of context, that's the first speech of
that's
Lily.
I think it's two speeches, yeah, two scenes put together. Yeah.
And I mean, in the course of the play, we have this. Marion arrives into the house, and Lily is the ghost, yeah, kind of figure. Can you talk a little bit about the relations between the Catholic and the Protestant figure there, between Marion and kind of Lily, how that plays out over the course of the play?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking about this in bed the other night, which I do most of my best thinking. Lily, we don't know what Lily was like. Lily doesn't appear in this play. It's only her ghost. And it isn't a ghost, because, I mean, if you believe in ghosts, well, that's all right. But what she really is a projection of Marion. Marion's fears, Marion lost a baby. Marion's baby was lost through a cot death. And the marriage then broke up. And the beaten wife was beaten up when she was pregnant and lost the baby and can't have any more. So that's the two women who are real women who have lost children and are heartbroken about it. And then Marion discovers that Lily had a baby and it wasn't her husband's. According to Marion, the husband, when he came home from Passchendaele and Hellfire Corner, was impotent. And so Lily was a virgin wife until she was 30. And then they had this airman came over from England, a pilot, beautiful blonde pilot, who reminded Lily of the picture in her Bible of the archangel standing at the gates of heaven, except he was no archangel. And he and Lily had an affair. And this was while the husband was away off searching for work in England. And she had the baby, and according to Marion, what Marion thinks happened from things she finds in the house, that she left the baby on the steps on the steps of a Baptist church in the hope, because it was a rich congregation, in the hopes that it would be adopted by people in this church rather than put it in an orphanage. And she left it all happed up in a wooden box and walked away. Nobody knew she'd had a baby because she was on the fat side. How well I know what she means. And so she, not because I've had a baby, because I haven't. anyway, that's the parallel of the three women who had of all lost babies through one way or another. And Marion is hurting very badly at this time because it's not long since she lost her baby. And so although she knows something about the real Lily through seeing things, you know, there be photographs and husband's service medals and things that were lying about the house. Really, when we see Lily, we are seeing Marion's idea of Lily. And Marion, of course, is a Catholic, and Lily was a Protestant. And so what we're seeing of Lily is Marion's idea of what an old Protestant East Belfast woman would be like. And she might be right, and she might be wrong. We don't know.
Mm.
But it doesn't matter, because really the important thing is the projection of Marion's own ideas and feelings that we're seeing, which is so important.
Mm-hmm. And there's a shared suffering and humanity,
yes,
that kind of connects the
absolutely.
Two. I mean, there may be all these tribal and territorial divisions, but they're kind of over-transcended.
Yeah.
I mean, Adrian, you mentioned to the engine of the play being terribly kind of important. When the play was first staged in 1987, it got a bit of a critical kicking from a lot of pundits or kind of critics, that because of the play ended, even though the play is set in 1974, and Parker has a negative view as to the significance and signification of the Southern Gate Executive being collapsed. The play itself was seen as an optimistic kind of play in the teeth of this kind of comedy of terrors, as Parker talks about it. Could you talk a little bit about the ending of the play from your perspective?
Yes, but it is a positive ending, and it's it's a positive ending from a Protestant playwright who's saying that there is a place for us all together. You know, there is a place that we can all exist together if we all kind of, you know, embrace who we are, be confident about who we are, if you like, in many ways, and if we can forgive one another. And in fact, that's what happens at the end of the play. That Marion comes to terms with Lily. And she wants, you know, she starts to understand Lily because she starts to understand herself. And, you know, Stuart puts these four people together who are kind of a bit disparate, but, you know, because they're hothoused together within this house and they can't get out, and they have to examine who they are, and they have to look at what their priorities are, that they all come to understand how much they have in common, rather how little they have, you know, apart. So I think, but he was a tremendously positive person himself. He went through huge health issues all his life, and was very positive about all that sort of stuff. He never let that kind of stuff get him down or stop him from doing anything. So he really had that kind of great spirit about him. So he carries that spirit into his work, and the play is a tremendous springboard, if you like. You come out of his play thinking, my God, you know, that was such a tense time for everybody, and everybody just held themselves through it, whatever happened, because it did feel like everything had fallen apart. It did feel like, you know, suddenly, the streets, you didn't know who owned the streets anymore, whether it was safe to go on the streets. There were huge swathes of the country that were ungovernable as such. And the ending still remains one of the great epiphanies, if you like, in Irish playwriting. And I've used it myself in a short film that I shot about the city. I've used it as the last speech, his last speech, because I still think it says a lot of the things that I feel that I'd like to say about here. You know, positive things that I'd like to say about here. I don't know whether Barry wants to say anything about it. No?
I think that's kind of an important note, that these are history plays, and quite often
the Joycean idea of history is a nightmare from which we're trying to awake gets invoked. But what I think is very important about Parker's plays is that they're history plays, but they're history plays about the future. You know, they're very much about looking at the past. You know, there's a great quotation he gave in a speech in the Whitla Hall in 1984 where he says that every day the plea goes out to forget the past. It says a certain voltage today. Such pleas are both pernicious and impracticable. You know, it's only we only get to a healthy society through remembering and not through amnesia, which again seems very kind of prescient for where we are kind of today.
Absolutely. But he was charting a journey out through the place, I think, for himself and the people who he came from. I do feel like he was a prophet in that respect, and offering a way, especially to disenfranchised Protestant youth, to see themselves contextualised within the island of Ireland, as well as being British and having their British heritage, as also not denying part of their Irish heritage, which he thought was very significant and would sustain them in trying to understand what this place was about. And until they allowed themselves to look at both those things, they'd never be able to come to, you know, to have a find a political solution and find a way out. So I believe he's a tremendously important figure in that respect.
It might be just an opportune juncture really to open it up to the floor for any kind of questions from yourselves.
I have a question. It's related to his introduction. Thank you very much. That was illuminating in a way that I think is related to Stuart's introduction. He says in the introduction to the triptych, rather than a trilogy, this he's talking about the first play and the second, and then he gets to the third play, and he's quoting Stuart. The third play is written in a form of hyperrealism. This seemed the most appropriate for my own generation, finally making its own scruffy way onto the stage of history and from thence into the future tense in this climactic piece. Why did it take him so long for his own generation to make their way onto the stage? I think it's really significant that in Pentecost he suddenly sees the arrival of his own generation onto the stage, and that in a way is kind of my question. Why does it take them so long to make their way onto the stage?
Because the Protestant working class don't have a history of going to the theatre or writing plays or being involved in the theatre. Gone Purvis's recent play was in the Opera House. Prior to Gone, and prior to that, the street where she lives, the people wouldn't go to the Opera House because it wasn't for them. It was just around the corner of Donegal Pass.
That's actually a great myth. You look at the great...
It's not a myth.
Well, in the sense that Tom Carnduff, working class Protestant shipyard workers, Sam Thompson, quite recently, the first time a writer in this city has
stands out.
Yeah. Sam Thompson, Thomas Carnduff, there's plenty. I mean, Wesley Hutchinson, I think that's his correct name. I don't mean to make an ad hominem attack. Quite recently criticised the Mac and the Lyric for not doing enough for working class Protestant audiences in this city. By his own admission, he had never been to the Lyric or the Mac.
That's the point.
But from January until June, there was a series of an unbroken succession of working class plays with working class Protestants, with Mary Jones, St. John Irvine, Gary Mitchell, David Ireland, and a new Graham Reid play. And in fact, one constituency that wasn't represented on the Lyric stage in 6 months was the Republican working class audience. So there is, I mean, Gary Mitchell also will say there's nobody working in the working class Protestant tradition. There were more working class Protestant playwrights than there are middle class working class Protestant playwrights. We just don't know the history.
Working class playwrights. I said they were rare, but the Protestant working class don't have a history of going to the theatre and being involved in the theatre.
Excuse me, I worked in the old group theatre, Goldblatt, McCandless and so on, and we had a very substantial working class audience for years and years. This is before they threw Goldie out. So this would be in the late 40s, early 50s. And people came to every play. And we ran plays, they ran plays for, you know, if they ran, if they got enough audience, they ran them as long as they could, because of course you made more money that way. But people came to every play and they'd say to us, when's the next play going to be on, you know? And, this is working.
It's,
hmm?
It's not on a wide scale. I don't want to get into the whole argument.
Well, maybe. I don't know.
His generation. Well, you know, when I think of Stuart, I also think of Van Morrison, interestingly enough. And I think, and the other thing was, I think Stuart, it was a very interesting house that he was in when he was here at Queen's. I believe Eamon McCann would have been there. I think also Raymond Ferguson, who went on to become an official unionist candidate where I'm from, in Fermanagh, was there as well. So it's quite a hodgepodge, you know, an interesting grouping of people at Queen's at that particular time. So you would imagine why did it take it so long for that particular generation to shuffle onto the stage? I don't know. I think it was very difficult. You know, it was difficult to contextualise it all. It was difficult how to put it together. You know, how do you suddenly try and make sense of this new state? You know, Ireland's a sovereign country many millennia. There's a new state that suddenly happened. How do you then kind of talk about it? How do you talk about your place with it? How do you identify those elements that go to put it together? And Stuart, you know, identified them within, you know, Passchendaele, Hellfire Corner, those things, you know, his uncle being a gunrunner in the UVF, you know, those elements he knew were the kind of the totems that kind of held this new state together. So they had to be in his play. But there had to be other things in his play as well, so he had to deal with those first. He had to deal with what he saw was his natural history first, the wolf tones and the, you know, the Cave Hills and all that stuff that you see in Northern Star, you know, the Presbyterian, the great Presbyterian, you know, history that's you know, with an Irish history legacy, with an Irish history. So he had to deal with those things, I suppose, first before, you know, he managed to do something. And he picked the strike because the strike was like, you know, it's like it's a great filmic idea. You know, it's like, you know, making a film in a prison or putting a play where somebody has to defuse a bomb. You get to keep all the main characters in the one place and they're under a lot of pressure. So choosing the strike was a wonderful way of pressurising four people to actually talk to one another. And like you know, and actually speak about how they felt, and the strike did that to people. It drove people into their houses. It drove them, you know, into questioning what they were about, what the whole thing was about. And I think that was a very clever device for Stuart to use that. And also the fella coming back from England, who knew nothing about it, is a very good, a very funny character, by the way. And there's massive amounts of humour in Stuart's plays, by the way. You know, that has to be recognised, of course. Everything floats on the humour of that great black, you know, that Belfast humour that he uses all the time, that was very prevalent throughout this period because people needed it.
When the electric came back on, they said something about, now we've got power without responsibility.
That's right, yes.
I was sure to say.
Yeah.
Barbara, you also mentioned about the fit-up companies that you worked with, obviously, well before working
with Stuart.
I mean, I'm just going to go back to that issue about, I mean, where did you kind of play into what kind of audiences were you playing? Was there any kind of relevance there?
In the fit-ups in the 50s? Mm-hmm. Well, we played a different play every night for 7 nights and then moved to the next wee town and played them over again. It wasn't fun. I suppose it was all right because I was only in my 20s then. But no, we had very ordinary audiences. I mean, we were playing all down the west of Ireland from Donegal to Cork, and there weren't any posh people around there. I mean, there were some people with money, mind you, but mostly we just had farmers and shopkeepers and whatever.
And did you turn in north though as well?
No, this was a southern company.
Okay,
I was the only northerner in it.
Okay.
They were very kind to me also.
A few more questions.
I think it's a bit of a current myth that the cross working class were in the theatre, didn't go to the theatre. Plays were performed in church halls, yes. Plays were performed in both secondary schools and grammar schools. When you came up to Queen's University, you joined in that sort of mix of sort of the intelligentsia, if you like, at Queen's University, which Stuart was part of, along with the young McCann and other McCann. Rhoda Hume was here. Parker's producing plays all the time. He was here. And then there's Bill Morrison writing plays.
Yes, of course.
Mix in the period 1959-63, and then it carried on. Ulster was also full of amateur dramatic societies.
Yes, that's true.
Tremendous excellence.
Yes, Bangor in particular.
And they fought their way through to perform in the opera house, in the annual event. And Brum Henderson was chairman for years of that, but so also was Ralph Fryer, as I remember.
Yes.
So there was a great interest in theatre, there still is a great interest. Theatre. Mm-hmm. I think you have to watch we don't buy somebody's myth at the moment that the Protestant working class were any different than the Catholic working class. Both cultures,
yes,
in the Catholic and Protestant working class culture, was very live and vibrant, especially whenever the city was full of housing. You know, Belfast has lost an awful lot by losing so much of its community to new towns and so on.
Mm. But that's different, that's amateur.
Theatre. That's
what
feeds professional theatre.
Yes, it does.
I don't know whether I should tell the story, but I'm going to anyway. Mary O'Malley, who was a wonderful woman and did terrific work for the theatre, but she said to Sheila McGibbon, who was married to a Protestant, she said, "Sheila, they're not like us. They don't have the feeling. Protestants can't act, dear."
And how wrong she was.
How wrong she was. But you know, there was a feeling for, when I was very young, which is before your time, there was a feeling that only Catholics acted. It was sort of, you know, that Protestants didn't act. And some of us did, of course. I was very lucky. My mother was a very sensible woman and said, "Well, if that's what you want to do, do it." But there were quite a few. I mean, Jimmy Ellis and
Sam McCready.
But there was definitely a feeling, and a lot of the theatre, I mean, Mary O'Malley's theatre, they were run by Catholics. And there were an awful lot of Catholics in the group. But of course, there were Jews and Prods as well. But there was that feeling that Catholics got the jobs. There weren't that many Protestants. And
I think the question we might be asking here is, how come, if we're going to see these plays and that there are plays being written, that why the lessons of the plays, or what's being talked about in the plays, isn't filtering through into mainstream society? Maybe that's the question, because we're wondering, we're trying to answer it the wrong way, right? We're kind of saying to ourselves, well, how come the attitudes and the mores of the likes of Stuart Parker isn't bleeding through then into mainstream society? If people are going to see the play, and what's stopping that kind of enlightened spirit from advancing within our society? I suppose that's really the question. If everybody is seeing it, and being moved by going to the theatre and being moved by seeing these things, how come it doesn't then get any further, as a groundswell of opinion to then change the attitude? Because the theatre is a political place. That's why it was there in the first place, that, you go there to kind of be enlightened and to be enlivened. And So I suppose that's maybe the question we should be asking. We're probably saying, you know, looking at it the wrong way around and saying, well, I mean, obviously Protestant working classes mustn't go to the theatre, but that's not the case, as we know. So why then, you know, are the lessons that we learn within the theatre written by these great playwrights, and you've just named a whole handful, like even Bill Morrison and people like that, why have those, why has that not translated itself into a further enlightenment within the political establishment?
Well, I remember going to the theatre above a pub in New Lodge Road. I can't remember. It was an upstairs pub. Most of the cast in that particular theatre company, Desmond Cranston was acting a role in it, and he went on to work in the University of Ulster in drama. Some people may know. I taught with him in 1966. But it was Cat in the Hat, Tin Roof that they were playing on the New Lodge Road above a pub there, and it was a Protestant Catholic audience and a Protestant Catholic cast, and that's what was quite possible and normal in those days in Belfast. This was before 1968.
Yes. And you know, that never changed. What James Connolly called the imp of sectarianism, thankfully, never really made its way onto any stage, anywhere on this island. And we've always been proud as actors that that's never been something that we've ever had to worry about, because you know we work through one another and we work with one another, and we've always known that's something that we had to maintain. So, that still is the case here. And we have a wonderful theatre here, new theatre, revamped Lyric Theatre, which is, one of the most beautiful theatres in the UK. Which is about to do Pentecost, as you rightly said. So,
and also during that time, the BBC was able to give roles to actors. There was a very, very active production regime in the BBC in the 60s and possibly in the 70s, and people like Neeson got lots of parts, and even through the Schools Broadcasting Service, mm-hmm. actors were getting a living partly through the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a couple more kind of questions here.
Yes.
One, two, and three, please. Okay. So, in any kind of order.
Thanks. Just wondering to what extent you think that Pentecost represents what was going on at the time that it was written, rather than the reflection on the time frame that it's set in, and if there's any kind of attempt to use 1974, or use the storyline in Pentecost as a kind of a lesson for where Northern Ireland was at the time that it was written and the time when it was performed.
I don't think it was an actual reflection on the strike at all. It was using the strike as a background and using the strike as a way of. I mean, they mentioned the strike. You know, Peter comes in over the back wall and kind of with his big bag of muesli, because he reckons he buys a huge bag of muesli because he reckons that's going to do him over the couple of weeks. Nobody's ever seen muesli, by the way. You know, he arrives in from England with this big bag of stuff and you go, what the hell's that? So he arrives in and he's trying to make sense of the whole. So he's asking questions, which is great to have a character coming in and asking questions, but no, it's not a play that's a reflection on the strike. It uses the strike as a background to other more deep-seated things that are prevalent in there.
It's not particularly a commentary on the time that was written on the 80s.
No.
It's more on the general kind of underlying problem.
Yeah.
Though he did have notes, and he did keep meticulous notes about the 1974 strike, and he used a lot of that material. He also wrote another play called Kingdom Come, which was directly informed by the 1977 strike, which was a disaster, and he wrote a play. He saw this as a euphoric kind of moment when actually the people didn't respond to the appeal to go out on the general strike. So
there was a parallel kind of path there, but yeah, it was a reflection, but he has a lot of raw material from that period too, which he quarried for the play. Sorry, Andrew, did you want to respond to that? Or?
It was only in answer to that, because he wrote the Iceberg play during the 1974 strike, because he cycled into the BBC through the Ulster Workers' Strike with the script, and it's dated May 1974. And he says in that play there's a line, it's supposed to be about 1912. He says, at least they had the sense to strike, which I think is a very interesting line in that script, which is what writers do.
I just got sorry, Barbara, for kissing Barbie, but I was looking up your profile on IMDb, and it seems you're 84 years old. You're
83! I'll not be 84 till October.
83! And you're still working, and as I understand it, you're on BBC One and Sunday Night and Quirk. So I must say,
oh, is Quirk coming out on Sunday? Oh, thank goodness.
An inspiration for a long and rewarding career, I hope. So my question that I suppose there's a question actually. Not to go off topic, but when we've got both of you in a room, what's your view now with the current scene in Belfast for actors? Because we've got Game of Thrones here now, we've got Line of Duty, we've got The Fall.
I'm not in any of them. I've done nearly all my work in the South. I don't know why. They don't like me up here. It's not fair. Quirk was in the South, you know. And that's about 2 years ago that we did that, although it's only just come out. And my part has, a lot of it went onto the cutting room floor, so don't hold your breath. I got my fee.
Which channel is it on?
It's on
BBC One. I think it's on BBC One.
When is it on?
BBC One, Sunday.
That's where it went. Sunday.
Did you plant him, Barbara? he's not your manager, is he?
Things are very good. Things are very good. Back then in 74, you had the Arts, you had the Lyric, you had the BBC who did radio plays, and basically that was probably it.
Yep.
And so there was very little outlet for actors, and you know, and then, you know, subsequently, especially the actresses in town decided that they'd have to do something about it because there was very little work for them. Shara Banks started in the early 80s, which was a huge explosion of energy and interest in the theatre. And now we find ourselves in a position where young Northern Irish actors in London who would normally decide to stay in London because they're now coming home immediately after leaving drama school, and they're coming back to Belfast, and because they know there's more work for them here in the city, and that can only be a good thing. It's a very good time to be a young actor in Belfast at the minute because of these shows.
It's not so good being an old actor. I specialise in dead. I'm very good. I've been in a coffin more times than
I've been since 1987 too in Pentecost.
Yeah,
that's right.
Dead and ghost.
So it's a great time to be an actor here.
Yeah.
Again, I'm going back to the only question about the ability of the theatre in its broad sense to influence people. I disagree with Henry that you can talk things up maybe a wee bit too much, but the recent rerun of Oshadian of Sam Thompson's Over the Bridge play, the project of World War II, a group of IRA veterans from Operation Harvest, the 56-62 campaign, and colleagues and friends from Royal Irish Rifles Combined or Comrades Association. A pretty eclectic bunch of actors in the waterfront.
Yeah.
Apparently all of the shows were very, very well attended.
Yes.
That Saturday, I had enough after play talk, people, some of the actors, some of the playwrights, some of the people, Jay was there, Sam Thompson's estate, but I thought it very enlightening that one of the guys that was there, it says, was the THQ staff, IRA THQ staff operations officer at the time of the border campaign back then, and had carried out operations here in the north. And he had said to, I think, says, in the intervening years, his viewpoint had changed on militarism and physical force. But he had said to, he thanked the actors and to all the people who had organized the offer play talk. But he said that looking back on reflection, it was while they, members of the Irish Republican Army, were involved in mounting that campaign to smash the Northern Ireland state. He admitted to those listening that he now recognised that Sam Thompson's play had caused more discomfiture to the Unionist establishment than anything that the IRA columns were doing at the time. So
well,
it took him maybe the guts of 50 years to actually sit down and see the play and make maybe some comparisons.
Yes.
Within thing, but
well, play is it.
We're slowly, if it makes sense, becoming more and more comfortable with through the theatre and other mediums of us taking the opportunity to really look at ourselves.
That's cr-
and not just the things we want to hear people telling us about ourselves.
Well, that's right, and that's why the theatre is everybody's home.